Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. We put on events in spaces and in venues of all sizes in Ireland and abroad where people tell stories and talk about stuff. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. It's time for the annual Banter Review of the Year, the show where we look at the news stories of the past 12 months which have had the most traction. As you can imagine, there were lots of mentions of Brexit and Donald Trump from our guests Fintan O'Toole from the Irish Times, Elaine Buckley from the Fair Game podcast, Anna Cosgrave from the Repeal campaign, and Emmett Condon from Homebeat and Another Love Story. But there are also mentions in the mix too for Robbie Brady's header against Italy, Leonard Cohen, Axel Foley, and much, much more. Nice quiet audience. No one in the first three rows. Can only be the Banter Review of 2016. Hi folks, welcome along to Banter. Here's where we put 2016 to rest. The caveat is, of course, that there's three more weeks left in the year. So given what's happened in the last 11 months and 2 weeks, we don't know what's going to happen. So anything we don't cover tonight, we'll come back and cover on New Year's Eve. So I'm joined tonight, by, my name is Jim Carroll, the host of Banter. Thank you very much for coming out. Thank you very much for coming along to Banter number 157. Without you, we'd just be talking to each other and no one here. At the very end of the table here tonight, we have Elaine Buckley from the Fair Game podcast. Next to her, we have Anna Cosgrave from the Repeal Project campaign co-founder. Next to Anna, we have Emma Condon from Homebeat and Another Love Story. And this gentleman here on my right is Fintan O'Toole from the Irish Times. He's also a certified Egypt. Please give them all a round of applause. I'm just going to start with each one of you. Just going to start with Elaine at the very end. What was your story of the year?
I think the story of the year, like it had to. Sorry to draw the obvious one. It had to be the election of Donald Trump. Like it's really like nothing. Nothing tops that for when we're going to look back at 2016. I think that's it. More so the defeat of Hillary Clinton, which as a woman was just horrifying to see who she was beaten by. But yeah, that would be the main takeaway from 2016 for me.
Okay, Anna, what was your story of the year?
I'm going to have to echo Elaine's sentiments, just that general what the hell is happening kind of thing. Both Brexit, Trump, and then looking at Syria kind of all amalgamates into one sort of crisis.
Were both of you surprised or shocked by the fact that Trump won?
I wasn't. I actually, a few weeks before, was looking at polling and thought that it was grossly kind of underestimating what was going to happen. And I was having casual conversations with friends and I just thought what was happening with Trump was just echoing what had happened in Brexit. And that was that no longer are politics kind of left and right or tax and spend. It's actually those that embrace or reject globalization. And yeah, I feel it was maybe an inevitability.
Emmett, what was your story of the year?
To bring it, I guess, slightly back to close climbs, the one for me was the very untimely passing away of Conor Walsh, the fantastic musician from Mayo. He was a pianist. He made beautiful minimal music, which was very Irish-tinged. He made it in Mayo in his grandmother's hotel in Swinford, but it had a very international flavour. And I think he just released his first EP and was poised to maybe swoop on a world, and definitely, you know, on an Irish scene and on a world scene, I think he was about to take off. So that for me was really the endearing story. April 14th will be changed, I think, for me for a long time to come. But obviously on a world scale, yeah, Trump. I think Trump was, I think he did the thing that was clever, that he stopped, he didn't play the politician's game, he didn't pretend to be perfect on his stage. He didn't say I was perfect, so when people threw stuff at him that proved he wasn't perfect, he just batted it off. And that's a game changer for me, I think. I think he's proved that popularity and, you know, the manipulation of Facebook and news has changed the game of politics completely. So, yeah, those two things, I guess, were the general feel of it.
Okay. Fintan, what was your story of the year? Microphone's there.
Oh, sorry. I suppose the story of the year really is that there is no story. You know, that story implies a kind of narrative. A narrative implies a beginning, a middle, and an end, and some sort of rational sense that we can see how things are going to develop. And really the story of this year, and I don't remember a year like it in this regard, is that all bets are off. You know, there's the sudden realization that all the institutions we've taken for granted, including you know, liberal democracy itself mm-hmm. cannot be taken for granted. I mean, they're all up for grabs. Everything's up for grabs. The assumption that there were certain things you could say and certain things you couldn't say, you know, that you couldn't run. Like Trump's last television ad had three Jews and a voiceover saying they're taking over the world, you know. And it didn't name them as Jews, but everybody watching, you know, knew that they're very well-known American Jews, you know. It was pure anti-Semitism. I mean, it was pure stuff out of, you know, 1933, you know. And you would have said a year ago, ah, come on, you know, that's not going to happen. That's not possible because there are certain barriers around. We have some sense of history, some sense that you don't go there. You don't do certain kinds of things. You don't elect a self-declared sexual predator as the United States of America. I mean, that just doesn't happen. And I remember writing a piece, I think, in January last year, listing, I think, six things that could happen in 2016. And it was a kind of a provocative piece saying, look, let's wake up, folks. We're in a bit of trouble here. But, I mean, of the things I listed, I think five of them actually happened. You know, and they were kind of, it was like saying, you know, Trump could be the president of the United States. You know, the European Union could be on the way to breaking up. So it's just that sense, I think, that our sense of limitations, our sense of institutions that give some kind of meaning, whether we like them or not, to our public lives, they're all very, very fragile, and the Earth's crust just suddenly feels very thin.
Yeah, I mean, to say something like Trump winning, like Anna, yeah, something like that. The way that campaign ran, and also say the way the Brexit campaign ran, and the way the Brexit campaign suddenly kind of put outsiders front. You're involved with the repeal campaign. What lessons did you take from that this year?
I think it's to not underestimate how polarized people have become from political statements from political ideologies, and to try and understand and empathize why some people are of some school of thoughts, like be it from education or how closely the church and state are linked. And when I look at Brexit and I look at Trump, it's to try not kind of be a thinly veiled bigot and call people racist. It's to understand how and why they actually feel that way and why they're actively making a political statement by electing someone that is going to, you know, be betting against them in their best interest. So yeah, I think there's a lot that you can take from it. It definitely, in terms of focusing more on educating rather than agitating, because again, there's that, you know, massive kind of, not middle ground, but like there's a populace of people who maybe don't know where they stand, and that's okay. How can we expect them to be as well versed as people who are so certain of their opinion because they've been maybe a little bit more well educated or don't rely as heavily on the church? So
do you think as well that, I mean, a lot of the narrative around the repeal campaign is about like taking almost what the marriage equality referendum was about in 2015. Do you think that's changed given what's happened this year?
I think they're very, very different debates. I think we can definitely learn that people no longer bear a lot of weight in taking morality from the church. I think we can learn a lot from, yes, equality. I think there's still a lot of work, as much as I'd love to go and like chain myself to the doll. I think in order for a campaign to be effective, we need to understand, just as I was saying, like the concerns of people, or maybe be able to answer some of the questions that they have adequately and kind of approach the conversation with a bit of kindness, as much as I want to kind of jump down people's throats.
Okay, but before we get on to kind of like, I suppose, Trump and Brexit, let's take it right back to kind of February this year. This is for this. We'll start with kind of like Elaine Emmett here, and this is the kind of the election earlier on this year, the Irish general election. You know, and like basically, Enda Kenny went to the country as Taoiseach. He returned afterwards, still as Taoiseach, but on the kind of ropey ground. What was your take on that? I mean, did you vote this year? What were the issues that kind of mattered to you in terms of the general election campaign?
Yes, I did vote. I was delighted to see a new party in the form of Social Democrats to give at least one new option available. I didn't really count Renew as an option, but I think my main takeaway from the election was that, like, especially particularly in a year that we spent remembering 1916, how so many people forgot 2008. It's just like that Fianna Fáil being re-elected, young people voting for Fianna Fáil, like, they're the reason that our generation are absolutely screwed in many ways. And I just thought the result was just really horrifying, actually.
I guess I'm probably like the worst example of all. Like, I voted in Dublin for the first time. I'm from Limerick originally. I voted in Dublin for the first time after being here on and off for about 10 or 12 years this year, which kind of shows you, I suppose, one, I'm useless, and two, that I suppose, like, I would see that maybe our generation are finally becoming politicised, and maybe, you know, matters like the gay referendum and like repeal have actually brought politics back to our generation finally, because we felt so outside of the institutions and so felt so disengaged with the institutions to this point that it's taking these kind of popular notions to bring us back into the political sphere. I'm not surprised. I'm never surprised that Enda Kenny's back in. I'm not surprised that Bertie Ahern has been brought back in, because people's memories are really short, and it seems to me politics is a game of, you know, of reaction. It doesn't matter who you put in. You know, like, we had Obama, now we get Trump. It doesn't matter who we put in next, we'll get the next fool until we as a body of people decide that these people aren't good enough. So it's up to us to vote. It's up to us to choose the people. It's up to us to create a system where people want to get involved in politics who are not just career politicians. We don't need career politicians anymore. They're the people who have run us into the ground. We need smart, capable people. And I think until that change really starts to happen in a large scale, we'll end up with the same thing time and time again. It doesn't make a difference who we vote in. And that might seem very existential kind of opinion, but I'm not sure. I'm not the person to give the answer beyond that, I think. But I think that's where I feel it is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the basic outcome of the general election was people, Enda Kenny lost the election and retained power, you know, just at a really simple level. So what people voted for is not what they got. And this really shows us, I think, the zombie nature of our politics. And it's not just in Ireland, you know, it's the fact that there is a disconnect, which is that you have an old, and in most countries, and certainly in ours, very largely unreformed political establishment, political system, set of political attitudes. And you have really fundamental changes and challenges going on underneath in society. And there's a complete disconnect between one and the other. I mean, the staggering thing about our election is that what people actually voted for, if you want to look at the numbers, you know, they voted for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, which are two identical parties, to actually form a government. You know, there's still a majority of people in Ireland who are conservative and who vote for the two parties which have dominated the political life of the state. Really, since the foundation of the state, but it's a decreasing majority. But it is still, you know, a healthy, solid majority. It's perfectly possible for those two parties to govern with a majority and to implement a program. And the fact that they refuse to do that and have got away with refusing to do it, you know, that Fianna Fáil has got away with the business of saying, well, we're both in government and in opposition. You know, we're really powerful and we really have big influence, but we're not responsible for anything whatsoever. You know, it is a kind of corrupted form of politics. I mean, it really is a refusal to take responsibility for the fact that you've stood for election and that you've got so many, you know, maybe more votes than some of us here would like to have seen. But the fact is, they did get a mandate to govern, and they will not take it. So we have this problem, and it's not just an Irish problem. You know, we're very much part of this broader a crisis of democracy. And my worry is that we're peculiarly smug about it in Ireland. Yeah. You know, we have a sense that actually, you know, it's all fine. It's the same old faces. They'll do the same old stuff. And, you know, it'll just continue. The fact is, they led us to an existential crisis. I mean, this, you know, I think what you were saying about forgetting about 2008, you know, we lost sovereign control. I mean, one of the weird things about the 2016 stuff is that I think one of the reasons we've embraced it so much is it is a form of amnesia about the fact that, yeah, we kind of got an independent country and then we lost it. You know, we ceased to be an independent country in 2010 when the Troika came in and governed the country. I mean, it is a matter of absolute fact. I mean, it's not a rhetorical point. I mean, the Bundes, the finance committee of the Bundestag in Germany was seeing and approving of the Irish budget before it had been released to the Irish Parliament or announced in the Irish Parliament in 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014. It only ceased when we were kind of released into, we were told we had been punished enough and we were going to be allowed to be kind of semi-adult again. So we lost sovereignty. I mean, there's no question about it. And it's as if, you know, we've kind of climbed out of that and then we say, oh, everything is fine now. It's all fine. And what you've got is this kind of zombie system, which is just kind of continuing. And actually feels almost stronger for the fact that it has survived this huge crisis. Yeah. The way the system thinks is, well, if we survive this, we survive anything. Rather than thinking, Jesus, we had a near-death experience, we better really start changing.
Yeah. You mentioned the smugness there, and like me and Emmett, you talked there about like mean the fact that you know the politicians we elect and the politicians we vote for. I'm curious about like mean for all of you, like mean where is this new wave going to come from? Like I was in Athens a few weeks ago, and like classic Jim Carroll, I walked into two riots one day after another. The first day it was against Obama, and the second day it was kind of November 17th, the anniversary of the first rising against the junta by students from the Polytechnic. And like mean they were out in the street, and like the first day it was just an angry anti-American sentiment. Second day there was more of that, but it was also kind of remembering what happened then. And just talking to people, I mean, they like the sense of poverty, the sense of hardship in that country is incredible. But they're not taking it, you know. And I know there's kind of like the difference between like the southern Mediterranean people, and they've got a history of kind of uprising versus here in Ireland, where we keep voting for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael because our grandparents voted for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. But what has to change, Emmett? I mean, you talked there about like I mean the politicians we keep elected. Is it the case that we have to change the people who actually stand for election?
Well, I think like essentially like the people there are a reflection of the electorate. It's what we asked for. Like it kind of reminds me of, you know, the skit with Roy Keane, they're like, but Roy, what about the Olé Olé's? There's kind of a protest class that go to every protest, you know, whether it's against Lidl or water charges or Tesco or whoever else. And that's become really ineffectual. You know, those people who go to all those things, I'm sure, are very well meaning, but on a wider societal level, I don't think their protests have the impact because they are chaining themselves to the dole. And Anna very astutely says it wouldn't make any sacrifice for her to chain herself to the dole. Like you can drive a dumper truck through the dole, but you have to have like a Stonehenge and an Ackle these days or something like that to do it. You know, that's just, it's a comedy event at this stage. I don't know where it's going to come from. I guess it's going to come from us. Like it seems to me that people are more concerned about Trump than they are about the Troika, for instance. If people hear put the same energy on Facebook that they did, like given out about Trump on Facebook, into their own local politics, I think we'd have a much better country for it. So I'm flustered by it. I don't know where the answer to those people are, but I suppose it comes from all of us becoming more involved and more engaged. And it doesn't seem to be a question that's being answered at any stage to me.
You mentioned the Social Democrats earlier on, like Elaine, and like were you kind of like mean surprised by how little impact they had in the end?
Well, I think like
because I mean they were the party that like I mean a certain quarter of people were talking about as like this great hope, mm-hmm. and they like, returned the same number of TDs and then lost one.
Yeah, true. And but they also had a lot of people kind of very nearly making it in, like Gary Gannon yeah. who I was not my constituency, but I really really wanted him to get in. It was just I suppose to have an alternative when I was looking at their manifesto and I kind of saw my own beliefs a lot. And it was the first time since I've been of voting age that I have seen that. And in a way, when you look at the alternative at the independents, like you look at the Healy Rays and God above controls the weather, like it's baffling how some people get into power. But then the Healy Rays got, I think, the most individual votes of anyone elected in the last election.
I think the Healy Rays are the closest things we have to Trump, because actually like it's a reactionary vote. Like I think people from maybe in the capital don't understand the feeling towards Dublin when you're from Kerry, from the southwest of Kerry, who know when it seems that all the money and all the jobs and everything is up there, people maybe up here don't understand the level of anger about that when you are from those places. That's why those people get in there, because they look after their own. Yeah. When you're from Newcastle West, where I'm from, you don't have representation in Dublin. You don't have representation in the media. And even if you do, it's not perceived that you do. So like they're there because it's a reaction. Like why have the Greens not been forgiven, but Fianna Fáil are being forgiven? You know, like it doesn't make any sense. The Green Party should be there. Everyone wants a better environment.
I mean, I really do think people underestimate the feeling outside their own bubble of what's going on. The scariest conversation I had during the entire general election campaign was at a funeral in Cashel with one of Michael Lowry's workers, and they were raging about the fact that they didn't run a second candidate because he or she would have swept home. And that to me was just like, I was just kind of, No, that couldn't happen. And then when you look at the actual figures and the kind of like the supposed to polling they got back, it could easily have happened. And like, you know, again, like Finn, you're someone who's kind of like watched the whole kind of, I suppose, array of gone beans and clever people who've stood for election over the years. Some have been elected, some haven't been elected. Like, what's your take on why we don't see more people stepping forward?
Well, because it's a bloody awful job. And why is it a bloody awful job? Because of the way they do it. So the way they've conceived politics in Ireland. And this really goes back right to the 19th century. You know, it's the same system has been in place well before the foundation of the state, and it's still there. And, you know, so the bulk of Irish politics is clientelist politics, right? And client says politics is a transactional relationship, right? So it's not about saying, here are my ideas, here's the things I really want to do for the nation. It's about saying, if you give me your vote, I'll get you something in return. You know, and it's at a local level, it's at a familial level. And it's very much that idea that, you know, it's machine politics of that order. Remember, we invented this. I mean, the first mass democratic machine on earth was Daniel O'Connell's Catholic Emancipation Party that was built. It was an incredible achievement. I mean, one of the most astonishing things ever done, you know, and they invented it. But sometimes when you invent something and it's wonderful in a certain period, it sort of hangs over you. Then, you know, you can't get rid of it. It's like the British having their fucking monarchy and their House of Lords, and, you know, they can't get rid of it because, and of course, their system was very progressive in the 18th century, you know, but they're stuck with it. And we're stuck with this clientelist politics. And so the Healy Rays are you know, they're very, very good clientelist politicians. But if you're going to compete with the Healy Rays, you have to say, I'm going to go to all those funerals. I'm going to spend my entire life, you know, trying to get Mrs. So-and-so the phone connection that she's supposed to have. Or, you know, I mean, who wants to do that job? It's a humiliating, horrible, nasty, grubby kind of job. It's about lying to people all the time. I mean, what these people do is they're cutely using their power in local government to find out what somebody's about to get that they're entitled to, and then telling them before they're told, I got you that, you know. That's their life. I mean, who wants to lead that kind of life, you know? Is it worth the perks? Well, they obviously consider that it is. But you have to be a pretty miserable so-and-so to feel that that's the way you want to lead your life, you know?
Right.
There's a mixture of power and humiliation going on all the time. So how can we change it? I won't bore you with it, but we have to start at the local level. We have to start with doing democracy. The basic problem in Ireland is that we're brilliant at local level, where our communities are fantastic. All the energy, all the enlightenment, all the sense of solidarity, all the compassion is at local level. We have some of the best community organizations in the world. We have the GAA. We have all those kind of things which are astounding. But we have no local politics. You know, our local politics is an absolute joke. We are the most centralized democracy in the developed world. If you look at most democracies, at least 50% of public spending is done at local level. Here, it's 94% of all spending is done at central government level. So unless and until we have proper local democracy, which means that people get to make decisions about how they're taxed, about how that money is spent, making real choices, having to actually feel they've got some power rather than being clients of these creeps, the system is not really going to change. Because what happens then when you don't have the local politics at local level is you push it up to the national level. So we get a doll full of local politicians. And they're brilliant local politicians. They really do their job for their localities in that sense. If that's what you want, they do it very well. But it's a deadly kind of politics, because it means that long-term thinking about what's in the common good for the country as a whole is really quite marginal in the energies and the careers of these people. They can be the most appalling people, like Michael Lowry, whom you mentioned, you know. I mean, openly corrupt, you know, openly lying continually to the Dáil, you know, having offshore accounts, doing all that kind of stuff, corrupting a serious state process in terms of the awarding a second mobile phone license, and his vote simply goes up and up and up, you know, because he does it at local level. So we have to start with doing local democracy. And if there was one thing I could change about Ireland tomorrow, is I would empower local communities. And I think that way you would have the knock-on effect in terms of who goes into national politics.
Right. All four of you have kind of, like me, have kind of pointed to this kind of this deficit in terms of democracy in this country and worldwide. So as all four of you are talking about this, you can kind of understand why people are kind of voting for Trump. You can understand why, like, people are kind of voting in Italy right now, are kind of going behind the kind of five-star movement. You can understand why there was nearly a right-wing nutter elected in Austria. You can understand why Brexit happened. So is it the case then, lads, that we should kind of give up democracy and do something else?
If the price is right, definitely. if the Healy Aids are willing to give it up.
On a serious level, Anna, I mean, like, you know, you're someone who's been kind of like, he's been forefront this year in terms of, like, I mean, a really interesting campaign. You started it, you involved some other people, you brought it up there. Have you any, is there any temptation or compunction from your part to kind of get into the more serious politics, the more kind of like the politics that Fintan's been describing?
I've started assisting Senator Lynn Ruan. Obviously, there's, we could talk about the Shannon all day, but I think we're underestimating how we can and hopefully will at a local level try and foster civic engagement. Like often, if I'm talking to younger people, and you know, they're really well able to articulate their frustrations and kind of vent their anger, but they're not really sure how to appropriately like affect action. So I ask them, you know, have you ever even considered maybe, you know, taking up some time in one of your local TDs kind of, a clinic, and they'd be like, oh no. So again, if we were able to, you know, whether be it in education and kind of foster this idea that, you know, you can bring about effective democracy. I also think that there's, you know, a lot of disillusionment and people are disenfranchised because truth and politics aren't actually linked. Like we're seeing in the media that facts are defying logic. They're, you know, completely and outrightly blatantly lying. And especially that would be one of my like serious frustrations, especially with the Repeal the Eighth kind of movement, that people for a long time, for decades, have been getting away with owning morality and actually lying to people. So yeah, trying to better match truth and politics, which takes a long time. Like I think we're giving, say, the Social Democrats a bit of a hard blow. Like they're relatively new, you know, who knows after a little bit of time. I know I've just come from an event at the weekend that the senator was running called Tala Talks. And the idea was to kind of bridge the gap between mental health services and community members. And loads of people that came had been like really, really affected by cluster suicide, something that I didn't realise, you know, the kind of rates in somewhere like Tala. And it was amazing listening to people kind of share their stories and then services that were down the road from them that they otherwise wouldn't have found out unless this town hall happened. And now they've been matched. So I think kind of just bringing it back to that ideal of community building.
I mean, yeah, that's positive. You know, let's move on to something kind of like something else that none of you mentioned at the start, but I mentioned because I was fascinated by it, mainly because I didn't see it coming. And when you don't see something coming, you're always completely surprised. And you spend days trying to work out why it happened. That was Brexit. Like, I mean, whatever about Trump? I won money on Trump. I'll have to say, I had a bet on Trump, so I'm one of those sad people. But in terms of Brexit, I remember waking up on holidays, going to bed one night, just thinking, okay, but Brexit be carried. It's not going to be a problem. Waking up the following morning to see Britain had voted to leave the EU, and just I don't think I've ever been as shocked by a world event in all my life. Like, obviously they're now trying to work out how they're going to actually leave the EU, if at all. What was your take on it, Elaine?
I was the same. I actually, in terms of the lengthy campaign for Brexit, like I just presumed that it was going to, like obviously I just live in this glorious echo chamber where I just presumed that it was never going to happen. So much so that I didn't stay up that night to watch the coverage because I just presumed that it would not happen. And then I remember just waking up the next morning and just having this awful sense of just foreboding, really. And then that interview with Nigel Farage that morning where he was on ITV's This Morning, and he was questioned about, "Oh, are you all the money that you've promised that is going to go back into the NHS?" And he was like, "I never said that. It's like it's literally on the side of your campaign bus, quoted. I never said that." And it was just became quite evident quite quickly the lies and the manipulation that had been that they'd campaigned with to carry the vote.
And that goes back to what Fintan said earlier on, about Trump. I mean, it was a year. Maybe you mentioned something as well, Elaine, about an echo chamber. So it's a year of two things: a year of lies and echo chambers. I mean, first of all, you know, Anna, you were the one who talked earlier on about getting out of the echo chamber and kind of listening to other people. Did anyone here, like, I mean, listen to what the likes of kind of like Boris Johnson, like Nigel Farage was kind of saying, and think, okay, there's going to be people in Britain, our nearest neighbour, the place where we've exported so many of our people, the place we have a deep relationship with, the place where we support many of our really shit football teams. Did anyone here think it was actually going to matter? Finna?
Yeah, I always thought that if the English, so it's an English thing, this is about English nationalism, and I always thought if the English were given a chance to leave the European Union, they would leave. You know, English nationalism is a really underrated phenomenon. And it's underrated for a very obvious reason, which is it's being wrapped up in Britishness. And as Britishness starts to fall apart, as the empire, you know, it's gone. Finally, I think they finally realised it's gone, you know, it's taken a long time. So their aggressive nationalism has always been there, but it's been deflected into the empire, into Britishness, into all that kind of stuff. And I always thought that if in these circumstances, if you gave them a chance to leave, they probably would do so. So I wasn't surprised. I was still shocked. I mean, still, you know, you intellectually think something may well happen, but it's still absolutely shocking to see it when it is going on. But I think I realized it was definitely going to happen. I mean, and you know, the 350 million thing was mentioned on the side of the bus, right? So, you know, remember, we had 350 million we give every week to the European Union, which is a lie. And we're going, you know, imagine if we put it into the NHS, which was another lie. So it was two lies on a bus, right? And it was fascinating to watch because within a week it was demolished. I mean, it was absolutely demolished. I mean, every single independent expert came out and said, look, that's just a lie. We don't give 350 million a week. And by the way, you've promised that 350 million a week now to about 10 different people. The farmers are going to get it, the NHS is going to get it, the fishermen are going to get it. So you actually promised about a billion a week, you know. So like it's just an astonishing lie. Now, in the old world we were in, actually when the lies found out that they say, ah, well, we didn't really mean it, or it was a bit of a mistake, or, you know, let's take it off the bus.
We misspoke.
And they, you know, the fact that they just said, basically, two fingers, who cares, you know, we're going to keep saying it. And you realised, oh, they know something we don't know, which is that actually something has shifted now, which is that it doesn't matter. You can lie and lie and lie and lie and lie, and people want to believe it. And what people want to believe is the thing now, right? And it's not even necessarily that a lot of Brexit voters actually believed it. It's just that they wanted to believe that there was something there. And it's what happens, and it's like the Trump thing as well. It's what happens when people have nothing to lose. If you feel you have nothing to lose, then you really don't give a shit anymore. Like, all you really want to do is just kick these bastards, whoever those bastards are. And those bastards are very well defined. They're people with high education, they're smug people, they're the elite, they're the political system, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, when you kick something, you usually break your own foot. But a lot of people decide actually the pleasure of giving the kicking is worth the pain of breaking your own foot. I don't know if you remember the such a sad thing of the day after Brexit. I saw it on BBC News. I think it was in Port Talbot, which is the poorest place in the UK, in Wales. It's also the biggest recipient of EU funding. You know, and there was a guy standing there saying, "How did you vote?" He said, "We voted to leave. It was Brexit. We voted to leave. It's great. We're leaving." I said, "Yeah, but," and he said, "You know, what did the EU ever do for us?" Well, apart from, and he was looking around, you know, and it was literally all the buildings were built by EU money. Yeah, but apart from that, they've done nothing for us, you know. And it really was like the Monty Python, you know, what did the Romans ever do for us? And it's happening, you know, it's just happening in front of you where people are detached enough from their own reality. I think there's an element that's really not been written about or understood, and it's in the Trump and the Brexit thing as well, which is boredom. I think, you know, I think the lives of people in communities where all the industry is gone, where all the hope has gone, where the chances of getting a decent education are very slim, where the chances of your kid's life being any better than yours are very slim, it's apart from everything else, it's just incredibly boring. It's a very dull life. And the excitement of somebody like Trump coming and saying, it doesn't matter what he says, and actually the more outrageous it is, the better. And the people who really should be shot are the Borises and the Michael Goves, who are upper class, reckless playboys who are having an Oxford Union debate and don't give a fuck about these people's lives. I mean, they really don't. I mean, they are the most immoral people. They care nothing at all about these people's lives. And they just played it like it was a game. You know, it was a game. And which you realize, of course, I mean, we all remember seeing Boris's face on the television the morning of Brexit. He was like he'd seen a ghost. Oh shit, it's happened. You know, it was just a game. It was going to get him sort of up the ladder in the Tory party and sort of get one over on Cameron, whom he's been a rival with since Oxford days. I mean, it really was as stupid as that. And they're now left with, they don't have the back of an envelope. I mean, they don't actually have the back of an envelope even now about what are we doing? How are we going to stop life getting worse for so many of the people that we're supposed to be responsible for? And it's their sheer recklessness, which I think is just sickening.
The thing with Johnson and Gove, we should all remember as well, is that they're former journalists, so never elected journalists to a position of power.
Particularly newspaper columnists, they're the worst kind. You know.
But like, I want to kind of like turn again with this whole idea of kind of like fake news, because it's been brought up again and again. Did any of you notice in your social media feeds people that you regarded as pretty okay this year distributing, sharing, sending on news that you knew full well was just, hang on a second, that's not true. Be it the Pope endorsing Trump or whatever it was. Or are we all the kind of liberal smug media that these people all voted against?
I just think like you know, we all watch reality TV. The lines of these things have just been so blurred at this stage. And like I would echo what Fintan says. You know, like people are looking for excitement. Do people believe that Brexit is real or is it a TV show? I'm not sure. Like I'm actually not sure if they actually do. Like people are seeing Trump is like a reality TV character. Like Hillary was voted out for being a real person. You know, an actual real politician. Like people didn't want that; they wanted the character. So, like, I guess what we're seeing is finally, after a few years, is that the terrifying power of Facebook, the terrifying power of Twitter. There's no curation, and only now are those words starting to be uttered. That there needs to be some sort of protection in this. And to this point, it was all gravy. You know, we've finally seen that. You know, these things draw people together who are, you know, opinionated for all the wrong reasons. So, like. The words, the two words that stick with me for the year are echo chamber and post-truth. You know, so like, are we post-truth? If we're post-truth, we're in a really dangerous place. And God knows where it goes after this, because if the truth is gone, you know, everything's up for grabs.
Post-truth, Anna?
Post-truth, but also kind of grossly underestimating how polarized the world is, that the people who are voting against themselves are only doing so out of a globalized world which has fared them really badly, that they've got like a really slim picking and slim barrels, but we're kind of prospering on the up. So for me, I don't know, not that I'm an inner empath or kind of like understand kind of where they're coming from, but it's that kind of old age thing of like pedagogy of the oppressed. I was looking, there's kind of an academic out of Oxford, Alexander Brett, I think, and he specializes in immigration studies. And in Britain, areas where there was the least immigrants are the people that were most fearful of them. So it goes back to this idea of better civic engagement, of integration at a local level. Then this this link between fear and nationalism will less and less. And I'm just glad that you brought up that about that kind of old boys club and this like very much kind of empirical kind of tyranny, essentially. Yeah. So it's just it's a trickle down from that.
Yeah. In terms of post-truth, I don't like the term, and I maybe just take an hour to explain why. No, it's a very seductive term, and it absolutely seems to describe what's going on. You know, I don't know if you saw a really good example of. Do you remember? Stephen Colbert had the word truthiness, which he invented about 10 years ago, and truthiness is, you know, I feel it's true, therefore. It must be true, you know. It's a sort of idea that it's how you feel that matters, not whether there's any evidence for it or not. And that was satire 10 years ago. And this week, I just saw Mike Pence, now president-elect Mike Pence, you know, being
vice
asked.
President-elect.
Vice president-elect.
Unless you've heard of,
You never know. You never know. But George Stephanopoulos was asking him about Trump tweeted, of course, saying, you know, millions of people fraudulently voted. I would have won the popular vote only for the millions of people who voted fraudulently. Stephanopoulos says to him, so where's the evidence for that? And he says, you know, it was like you asked him, you know, how do you cook rabbit or something? You know, I was like, what? Like evidence? You know, and he said, look, President-elect Trump believes it is true. And he will always state what he believes to be true. You know, it's just like, so the satire has now been completely absorbed into the reality, right? So the post-truth thing is sort of seductive and it sort of seems like a good thing to say, but it implies that there was a pre-post-truth time. You know, there was a time when politicians dealt in truth. I mean, come on, you know. Lying on an enormous scale is a huge part of human history, you know, for maybe 1,000 years, most Christians believed that Jews practiced ritual sacrifice of children. You know, if you asked a person in a village in, you know, anywhere, you know, any Christian country, pretty much any time, say between 1000 AD and after the Holocaust, and said, you know, what do Jews do? They said, well, they kidnap Christian children, and they slaughter them ritually, and they drink their blood. It's a fact. We know that to be the case. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, you know, which was a forgery created by the Tsarist secret police in 1903, I mean, sold millions and millions and millions of copies, you know. And it purports to be the minutes of the meeting at which the Jews plan to take over the world, you know. And it's still in circulation, by the way. It's, you know, it's still out there. So my point is simply that there's always been a struggle. Truth has always been a struggle. I mean, to actually force people to look at evidence and to deal with reality rather than horrific fantasy has always been the struggle between barbarism and civilization. And really, when we talk about post-truth, the worry I have is that people, it kind of cuts off all that history. It's as if we're in a new thing. It's not a new thing. It's the old stuff. And that's what should scare us. It's the old stuff, and we know where the old stuff leads. We know what happens in societies where people give up on the struggle and stop saying, what's your evidence for that? Stop saying you're lying. And I know you're lying because of this and this and this. And I think the post-truth thing is almost a way of disabling us all and saying, well, we're not in that kind of world anymore. Well, we bloody well are in a kind of world where we have to keep insisting on evidence, on the distinction between what happened and what didn't happen. Google and Facebook have become the enemy now. I don't know if you saw the piece in The Observer on Sunday, where if you put, just type into Google, are Jews, just those words, six letters, it suggests then, the first thing it suggests is evil. And when you say, you press on that, of the nine things, the first 10 sites that come up, nine of them are about why Jews are evil and why the Holocaust didn't happen and why Hitler was a good guy. You know, this is Google. You know, they've allowed their algorithms to be gamed by the ultra-right. They've allowed a whole thing to happen where there's no difference now between did the Holocaust happen or did it not happen. Well, it's just a difference of opinion. You know, it's what you think. You know, whatever you feel matters. And we have to fight the stuff. You know, we can't allow this kind of post-truth thing to become so common that it makes us all feel that there's a despair about fighting that fight.
Right. Barbarism, civilization, post-truth, evidence, despair. Do you enjoy the Olympics, Lane?
I'm so glad you didn't make me follow that.
I'm curious about your take on it, because I mean, you were obviously doing some work at RT on as well, but obviously from the Fair Game podcast as well. I'm just curious, like, I mean, as someone who's chronicling what's going on in women's sports, just watching the Olympics, I mean, did you believe it?
Yeah, I do still believe in the Olympics to some extent, because as an avid follower of women's sports, it's 2 weeks out of 4 years where women are on a completely level platform with their male counterparts. So whatever about the trouble in Rio leading up to it, the complete distraction of the Pat Hickey case, at the end of the day, there was 2 weeks where you could turn on your TV and open your newspaper and there was just constant coverage of women, of female athletes. And you have the likes of Katie Ledecky and Simone Biles winning five gold medals. Like, just these incredible feats. And from an Irish perspective, you have Annalise Murphy winning a medal that she just worked so hard for the past 4 years. You have Natalia Coyle having a top 10 finish. It's just, I think the Team Ireland, the women in particular, just performed so, so well. Mm. And if anything to take from it, it would be for people now to recognise these women and follow their journey for the next 4 years. They've already started their prep for aiming towards Tokyo. But overall, as the Olympic Games, I really enjoyed it. I was working on it. I was working a graveyard shift in it from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m. every day. But like, it was, I really, 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 really did buy into it.
Okay.
And yeah.
All right. Like, what about the rest of you? I mean, like, you know, are you sports fans? Did you watch the Olympics? Did you believe in it? Because I keep using the word belief, because I interviewed recently Nikki Dryden and Alison Wagner. Alison Wagner is kind of like, people here would know, she finished second to Michelle Smith in 1996 in the Atlanta Olympics. And Nikki Dryden's also kind of a Canadian Olympian. And it's like, when they were talking about, like, I mean, the way the games have changed, the way doping has come in, the way you've kind of got systematic doping by certain countries, the way you can tell which athletes, especially in track and field, boxing and swimming, are kind of like, are having the needle in their arm, you know? It just struck me that it's post-truth. It's kind of like we've gone beyond the stage of actually believing that these sporting feats are actually genuine.
I suppose I wouldn't be a massive Olympic fan, to be honest, but I would follow cycling a bit, and I'm a huge rugby fan, and rugby has had the first kind of wave of inquest into professional doping in it. And obviously it's a sport that's very open to it, but it's physical nature. The Olympics for me are dead and buried. Like, I don't believe an inch of it. Like, and even if I do believe that 90% are clean, the intolerance of allowing the dirty athletes there for them to be actually like taken to court for it or taken to task for it, and the fact that they're often left back in after they've been taken to task for it and work with dirty coaches time and time again in both the Olympics and the cycling, it means that like such a great spectacle, I think, for the most part, is lost.
But one of my main takeaways from this Olympics was, say, in swimming, where you had some of the younger stars breaking through, actually speaking out against the convicted dope cheaters that they were competing against. You had Lily King absolutely blasting Yulia Efimova. You had Mac Horton speaking out against Sun Yang being allowed to compete. You had Michael Phelps blasting everyone. So I think for the first time, the actual clean athletes spoke out against it, which is crucially important.
Yeah, it's a change of culture, maybe. And the Irish walker, what's his name, Heffernan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, how many medals has he had? Like, has he gotten in like post the event, post truth of the actual race? This is great. We could keep everything as post truth now. Yeah. So the Olympics are funny. Cycling the same. Like Nicholas Roach moved, I think, last year, the year before, and like his dad, you know, is a huge a symbol of, you know, patriotic Irishness. Like anyone of a certain age will remember praying for Nicholas Roach in the church when he was in the oxygen tank at the top of Alpe d'Huez or somewhere like that, which I remember as a bit an 8-year old. But like his performances are clouded, very clouded, and he has never spoken out against it. He's never had the bravery to say one word or even half acknowledge it, and that to me is as good as guilty. And his son has carried on in the same way, refusing, like, signing up with Sky and other teams who have clouds over them and refusing to talk about it. I think the only way for these sports to succeed now is for the athletes to take charge and say no tolerance. We're not going to accept this. We just can't.
Yeah. Do we talk about Pat Hickey or do we leave him alone?
It was great crack.
Okay, we leave Pat alone. You know, if anyone's interested in more kind of talking about doping in sports, especially in cycling, there's a banter with Paul Kimmage happening as part of the first Fortnite Festival in January. So check that one out. Did anyone here enjoy? Did we all enjoy Ireland's triumphs and especially Iceland's triumphs in the Euros this year?
I certainly did. I was working on the coverage of the tournament, and by the time we got to match day 15, and when Robbie Brady stuck the ball in the back of the net, that was just one of the highlights of the year. It was just absolutely magic. And, you know, the resulting celebrations for it, I think it just gave, it's just such a simple thing. It's someone heading a ball into a goal, and it just brought everyone so much joy. Like, I've no shame in saying our whole production team went to Coppers that night to celebrate. They were playing, it was a Wednesday night, they were playing a replay. They just kept playing replays of the match on the big screen. Yeah. And every time he scored the goal again, everyone went nuts.
We watched that game in a restaurant in Spain, surrounded by Italians. We're the only Irish people on the entire island. The entire restaurant full of Italians. And we scored the goal. The feeling of joy was fantastic.
Yeah. It was brave, you know. I think the beautiful thing about it was that, you know, it's so hard, isn't it? Because sport should be escapist, you know. It should be a way of getting away from all the bloody awful stuff that's going on. And yet then we have to think about Pat bloody Hickey and doping and all these kind of things. And you get moments like that. So, that, you know, that Robbie Brady moment where, you know, he could have had the head punched off him. You know, I mean, it, you know, he really did. It was incredibly brave. He's a little guy. You know, he took the risk. You know, he had the imagination to go and do it. And that image of him running off to his brother and kissing and all that. I mean, you know, come on. Irish men have changed. You know, kissing your brother on television. You know, it's like, I mean, you know, you'd want to be an awful swine not to have at least had a little tear in your eye.
Yeah. On a similar vein, I was in Thomond Park for the match against Glasgow the week of Anthony Foley's funeral. And that was a remarkable thing as well, because Munster have gone through this, like Munster were kind of the Italian 90 rugby team for Ireland for a short period of time where everyone was the fan and they were loved by everyone. And then suddenly all the legends start to peter out and leave. And we found ourselves, you know, last year in this kind of black hole where fans were like the words like Munster fans, which was like the biggest compliment you could give any rugby fan in the world, were deserting their own team. And so many people went back that day, and that was a day that transcended all the things about performance and winning and money and coaching, and it showed it's reignited something in Munster dramatically, and it's so sad that it's taken that for it to happen. But there's definitely like a feeling of brotherhood that was lost they're all of a sudden like is just back because of Anthony's death, I suppose, and the outpouring of warmth that came after it. So sport gets tangled up, especially professional sport. That it really shouldn't be two words that are mixed, you know, professional and sport. Really, it doesn't really work in some senses, because you lose the essence of the simple joy of sticking the ball in the net. You know, that's what it should be about. So that was a great moment for me anyway this year. Yeah.
And what were your great moments? We've run through an awful lot of negativity, you know. And I mean, I don't know if you're a sports fan or not. So, but like, if you are,
I went awful quiet there because my dad was a rugby coach for a while. So like, my kind of soundtrack to my childhood was like rugby games. I have gone to so many, and I think there kind of is a certain place in hell if you're Irish and don't, you know, at least feel something on the day of match days. Has such a kind of such a special place definitely in my heart. I'm not as kind of read up as probably both of you are, but it's important.
So leaving the sports aside, what was your own highlights then? Cultural otherwise?
Or cultural highlights? Gosh, I suppose listening or absorbing everything that was going around the kind of 1916, like, I don't know, I think it made me examine a little bit more about what it means to be Irish and kind of look back and look deeper into the foundation of the state and kind of try and remember maybe how much more difficult it was for people who back then were trying to kind of fight for independence or justice. What other cultural highlights?
We'll stick with the 1916 commemoration for a while, you know. And I mean, I thought some of it was fantastic. I thought some of it was a bit overdone. But as Dermot Farrell commented at the weekend, she's like, we got 1918, 1919, 1920, 1921 to come. You know, we ain't seeing the end of this commemoration. Do you think is going to come a point where people are going to go, lads, enough already?
I don't know. I'd hope not. To a certain extent, obviously sometimes some of the ceremonious over patriotic stuff can be like a little bit too much to handle, but I think it does definitely serve a purpose in terms of younger people having an awareness of how Ireland kind of came to be. And I definitely romanticise over the idea that it was poets and teachers who maybe spawned a movement. So when we go back to talking about the kind of disillusionment around party politics, to try and understand actually how kind of a bit of change and rupture was brought about.
I was reminded of this walking down Talbot Street and seeing the plaque to where Sean Tracy was killed. And I was thinking, when it comes to commemorating Solihull Beg, Willoughby is kind of like all this happy clappy. Do you think those kind of issues are going to be addressed, Fintan?
Yeah, you know, I kind of think we've been lucky in a way, because we've sort of learned how to do commemoration just as we're facing into the really rough stuff, you know. So I think in general, you know, and I'm very critical of so much in Ireland, but I think the way, in general, the Irish public dealt with 2016 was brilliant, you know. It wasn't ethnic flag-waving chauvinism, you know. It was actually people trying to find a way of holding two things in their heads at the same time, one of which is that, you know, we are a nation for good and ill, and the other is that it's complex and ambiguous, and, you know, and I think actually people do that brilliantly. I mean, what other nation on earth, I mean, there really isn't one, I don't think, would have as its main, you know, on the day of the big celebration, the Easter Sunday, you know, you had big military parade, and then everybody goes up to the museum, you know, for 1,100 singers, and like a mad surrealist poet rapping about the nation and about how fucking awful the nation is and how we've gone bean men and you know, bad developers and bad banks and also lovely things. And, you know, I thought it was just like the Paul Muldoon thing is really riveting. Because if you saw it in a sort of fringe event somewhere, you'd say, that's really interesting. That's really great now. But to have it as a centerpiece of the official celebration shows in a way how I think the public have kind of forced the politicians to accept that there's nobody that can be trusted in Ireland except the artists. So the only people who can really speak for us in any kind of way are the artists, and they've earned the right to speak by the integrity of their art. And that's been really, really interesting, because it means that actually going into the really rough stuff around, you know, Solihull Beg and around the Civil War, you know, all that kind of stuff that we're going to have to face and try to think about, which we've never really faced as a nation, We at least know one thing, which is you can trust the artists to do really interesting things and to explore things in dark, mysterious, ambiguous, complex ways, but also ways that give us some kind of hope that we can make some sense of the stuff. Yeah. And, you know, there was really some
fantastic artistic projects, I think. Yeah. And I think the politicians have realized, Jesus, you know, actually this is a way of doing it, that we just let them get on with it.
Yeah.
And hopefully that's what they'll do.
Hopefully that's what they do, because, I mean, this week there will be a big government announcement regarding arts and culture, yeah. And it'll be interesting to see, like, who's going to try and claim ownership of that. And it's interesting you mentioned there about artists as well, kind of thing, because we started the year without a Department of Arts. You know, this is something that Etna Shortall kind of mentioned in the Banter Arts Review of the year at Other Voices. We started the year without an arts department, and we ended the year finally with kind of like the arts department being suddenly kind of pushed in there again. I mean, you're right, the artists kind of the ones who say much, but do we all think, you know, there's a disconnect. The public kind of believe in these artists, the public listen to these artists, support these artists, but those who are charged with funding these people actually making sure these artists can actually survive have no real interest or no real understanding. Who wants to take that one?
Well, I suppose I work in the arts, so that might half qualify me to some degree about this. And I work specifically with the idea of artists in space, so I'd address it in that way. And especially on the back of the Oakland tragedy, which just happened last week. And I think there's a lot of parallels in that here. And what I see in that is that where people like the government and institutions like Fáilte Ireland are very quick to uptake artists' output and use it to publicise a place like Dublin, which has an incredible artistic output, like one of the best in the world, undoubtedly. And that's not just Irish self-depreciation, clapping ourselves on the back to feel good about it. It's the truth, I think. And the support for artist spaces, places like Mabos, which I was involved in, and other small galleries and warehouse spaces, places where artists actually can afford to rent a room for maybe 100 or 200 euros a month and actually produce work. Because artists, like bankers, like economists, need actually a place to work. You can't just work from your kitchen all the time to create art. So the institutions are quick to take the produce and tell us all how great we are, but very slow to actually support us. Like in Grand Canal Dock, we see Boland's Mill being turned into apartments and offices. There's no, in the CDZ or the C, whatever the plan for the area was called, there was specific guidelines that there would be artistic space there. That's been ignored and thrown out the window. So what happens then is that the artists are forced into spaces which are on the edges, which is good in some ways for creativity. But if there's 30 people living in a space that goes on fire because they can't afford to work and live in a normal space, and it's so prohibitive to actually get the regulations to make that space safe, then you have a situation where that fire happens and people die. And I blame the government for that fire. I don't blame the artists, even though they'll be the ones who will be accused of not having fire extinguishers or fire alarms. The truth is those people can't afford those things. And the mechanisms for them to work in a safe space just aren't there. And it's the same here. And I would like to see that change.
That brings on to kind of like, I mean, another issue that kind of came up again and again this year, which is like, I mean, rent reviews in this city, the cost of renting in the city, homelessness in the city. You mentioned there, Emmett, about like being artists moving out to the edge. I mean, the edge now turns out to be Leitrim or Longford, you know? Yeah. I'm astonished at artists who can actually still afford to live in this city.
Yeah, like it's like people are genuinely struggling. People like it's. I have a lot of friends who are doctors and accountants, and they're struggling. So how if a doctor and an accountant with a traditional good job is struggling? How about the people who are like working a few shifts in a cafe and trying to produce art at the same time? So yeah, it's really serious things, and I think we've already seen a big drain to places like Berlin, and that's happened from the world over. But I think the beginnings of the move west has started. But conversely, then, in terms of a rural sense, that's a good thing. Lahinch is a little town that I have a close affinity with, and there's a community garden there now. A lot of people are starting to move that way, and maybe it's the natural cycle of things. Maybe we're not supposed to live in Dublin in Portobello if you're an artist. Maybe you're supposed to live gazing out at the winds of Leitrim and the bogs and you know, strolling Heathcliff like across the moors, waiting for inspiration. Maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. But I think we're in danger of pushing an artistic class which make this city so vibrant, not just to the edges, but entirely out of the place. Yeah.
Finn, have you something to add there?
Yeah, the philistinism at governmental and institutional level in Ireland is absolutely astonishing. I mean, as you said, the disconnect again, you know, so you've had the penny drop this year and they realised, oh God, we've got all these artists and they're the only ones we can really trust to mark something as important as the centenary of 1916. Why? Because they're bloody good at what they do. They're really serious people. They work over long periods of time to get to a level whereby they can express themselves with this kind of integrity. And then it's almost as if it's like in a parallel universe, you know. So the same government, you know, is taking a national cultural institution like the National Museum and saying, the Senate needs to be refurbished and we're moving in, you know. I mean, it's just absolutely astonishing. And so that's making a statement to every single cultural institution of the country that we own you. You know, we could just decide tomorrow that the National Concert Hall is unimportant. We really need it for, you know, the archives of the Departments of Foreign Affairs. You know, it's making that statement all the time. And so there is this huge disconnect. I think we're in a very interesting moment, though, and it's to do with some of the things that I was talking about, but, you know, it's to do with the fact that, like, the question of who the hell are we, you know, is no longer abstract. Because what we've been since, I was born in 1958, so the states had one idea since I was born, which was tax for multinational corporations, right? That was the idea it had. It hasn't had a single idea since then. I mean, it really hasn't. I mean, in terms of a new idea, you know, everything else kind of followed from that. You do what you need to do to have those kind of companies here, but the taxation is the big idea. And it's going really rapidly, you know, like, so it's over. You know, the Trump thing means it's over. Maybe one of the good effects of it, in a sense, the OECD stuff, European Union stuff, the Apple ruling, which we haven't talked about, you know, all of that kind of stuff, means that way of being Irish, that way of thinking about what the state is, a way of saying to somebody, look, you really should be here because this is a really great place. You know, subsequently, at the moment it says because you could pay 0.005% tax. And it's going to have to be about something else. It's going to have to be about saying this is a really interesting, creative, dynamic sort of place. And so, yeah, we don't want to see the kind of complete commodification and use and exploitation of the artists. But I think the state's going to be forced to say, look, we've nothing else to sell, really. You know, so maybe then we can get to a point where we realize that actually the only way you get good art is not by commodifying it and exploiting it. It's just by letting it happen, by creating the conditions. And a lot of it will be terrible, and a lot of it won't make you any money, and a lot of it will never go anywhere. But if you don't have an ecosystem that's creative, you're not going to have a future. You're not going to have an economy. You're not going to have a place that works in the world, particularly with Brexit, with Trump, with all the kind of huge developments that are going on. So I'm actually kind of, for the first time, in spite of all the philistinism, optimistic about the fact that they're just going to have to change.
Okay. I want to kind of turn to the audience. There's a ton of things we haven't covered. I mean, you there mentioned the Apple tax. Like, there's other things like Joe Cox. There's things like, I mean, obviously David Bowie, Prince and Leonard Cohen. There's the continuing kind of like catastrophes in Syria. There's terrorist attacks in Nice and Brussels. Dublin gangland murders. There's so much. But I want to get questions to the audience. Before we go to questions to the audience, I have one very important question for the panellists. Have any of you played Pokemon Go?
No, I never will.
No.
I tried to download it, but my phone was full. It was crushed.
Okay.
I just wanted to add something really quickly, just the way you touched on Apple tax, and then we're just talking about all these artistic spaces being taken over by massive kind of multinationals. Imagine if the investment that's put into fostering like technology startups was put into these spaces when we talk about the return on work produced by artists or by writers. It's just something that if any politicians are listening to, you know.
Totally. It's also been fitting with Philip's talking about the Apple tax thing as well. It kind of reminded me that I was in Lisbon for Web Summit, and like I was surrounded by these young, well-educated Portuguese people who could actually speak English. And I was thinking, like, well, the only advantage we really have is kind of, you know, this corporation tax thing. And then that night Trump got elected, and then the following day you realise it's a level playing field. You know, and like, you know, if I was coming over to Europe, the weather and the food in Portugal is not a lot better. Okay, the weather is anyway.
Well, the weather, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Questions from the audience? Just put your hand up. Yep.
You said earlier that you wrote a kind of a provocative piece last January about Trump potentially becoming president. It reminded me of an article you wrote last week about Michael O'Leary foisting a political takeover in Ireland.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, do you really think this is a possibility in 2017?
Is Michael O'Leary the Irish Trump?
So what I was trying to say in that piece was, look, if he wanted to do it, he could probably do it. I wasn't saying he does want to do it or that it's going to happen. But what I was trying to say is, look, you know, there's a real complacency in our political establishments, right? So the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael think it's fun to bring along Michael O'Leary to smear journalists, to, you know, attack RTE for all its limitations, you know, as a really important public service, you know, to just sort of abuse democracy, to, you know, and they think this is funny. They think it's fine and it's kind of gives them a bit of sort of a thrill. I think a sexual thrill almost they get out of it. And they just don't have a clue that if he was at all serious, you know, he has the money, he has the fan base, he has, you know, we now realize that actually the more outrageous the statements are, the better. You know, he's really well set up to think, and you know, by the time that Enda finally goes, by the way, so Enda's going to hang on for the Pope. You know, I mean, a lot of people realize, like, just how awful it's going to be, like, with this zombie Taoiseach. It's just going to stay there and hang on and hang on and hang on. And frustration's going to build up and build up. The homelessness crisis is going to get worse and worse. You know, all of those kind of things. And so the appeal of a sort of foul-mouthed, ignoramus strong man to come in. And I'm not saying that O'Leary's going to do it. I'm simply saying he could. And the very fact that he could should really frighten us, you know, because maybe if it's not O'Leary, it could be somebody else.
Exactly, actually. When I read that article, I was immediately thinking of kind of other potential or would-be or kind of like pseudo-strongmen who tried to throw their weight around. People like Declan Ganley, for example. We've seen this in the past. You know, we all think it's very, very funny. We thought it was very funny when Donald Trump came down the elevator in Trump Tower in June 2015 with his missus. And now look what we got, you know. Anyone any comments on Michael O'Leary?
Maybe he should stick to the racehorses. That'd be the best thing if we could keep him at that. I don't know. But
He moved stable this year, didn't he?
His trainer just won a record number of races, I think, in Navan or somewhere last week. Elaine, did you hear about that?
I don't follow Michael O'Leary's racing exploits.
I really think it's in our interest to rig the entire horse racing thing so that he keeps winning, so that he doesn't get bored. And, you know, that just puts his mad energy into that. That'd be great.
Just as the Miss Universe franchise is to Donald Trump, racehorses are to Michael O'Leary. Next question.
You kind of talked about earlier on about this post-truth kind of situation we find ourselves in, even though, you know, the term is up for debate. I suppose my question is, in a world where reason doesn't seem to work, that seems like a very, very scary thing. And that's one of the things I've taken from this whole year, is that if you can't appeal to people's sense of decency and reason with facts and truth, where does that leave us? How do we fight back? How do we fight back against people in a world where truth does not seem to matter whatsoever?
There's a couple of things. I think first of all, we shouldn't despair of it. I mean, it is important to remind ourselves that 2.2 million people more voted for Hillary Clinton than actually voted for Trump. Like, that the Trump thing, although in some ways it seems kind of inevitable, it's also accidental. I mean, if 107,000 people had voted differently in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, you know, between those three states, 107,000 people. That's all that Trump won on. So there is still a core of people who do kind of care about facts and policies and things like that. I think that the difficulty is that you're dealing with simplicity versus complexity, right? So what Trump realized and what the Brexit people realized is you can say anything in the negative, right? So you can simply say, when we get rid of all these bastards, this is going to happen, you know. The thing to remember about them is that their problem, in a way, is they won. So they have a real problem now, right? Which is that they made all these statements, which are complete nonsense. I mean, I think I quoted during the year, and I thought if there was one sentence that summed up the year, actually, it was a sentence that Noam Chomsky, when he was a practicing kind of linguistic philosopher, invented a sentence in 1957. He was trying to make the point that language is an innate thing that we have in our brains. Very controversial theory. But he says we're born with a linguistic ability and we know grammar, even though we don't know words. And to try to show this, he said, look, here's a sentence which makes complete grammatical sense. It was colorless green ideas sleep furiously. Perfectly grammatical, syntactical sentence. It's complete nonsense, right? And so I am going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it is colourless green ideas, sleep furious. I mean, it really is. It's just verbiage, you know. It's just language. The 350 million a week for the NHS, you know, they have no reality content whatsoever, and they were not intended to have, right? So this is why we're not at the fascist phase. I mean, when Hitler says the Jews are the problem, we must exterminate the Jews, he means to exterminate the Jews, right? Fascists are really serious about doing what they say they will do. Trump has no intention of, you know, rounding up 11 million illegal immigrants, you know, for example, or building the wall or banning Muslims. He can't, you know, he can't do those things. So and the Brexit stuff is the same. So what's going to be really interesting then is there is going to be a gap, and we have about 2 or 3 years, I think, in which there's a chance to bring it back, to say, look, those people lied to you. What they were saying was nonsense. And because it's nonsense, they can't do it. They can't do what they told you they're going to do. And I think there is real room for a fight back in terms of actual reality, actually saying, you know, this is reality, folks. You've had the fantasy. You took out the lottery ticket on these guys and you thought you won. And then when you went to collect your winnings, they said, actually, no, we didn't mean that at all. I mean, Trump was out the day after saying, well, a fence, maybe. Like, maybe it'll be a fence, you know? Or, you know, the Brexit. Well, actually, we never said 350 million, or we didn't really mean that, or, you know. So the fact that these people are not just liars, because we've had lots of liars before, but they're particular kinds of liars where there is no truth content whatsoever. They don't mean any of it. It's all a game. It's all reality TV stuff. It's all Oxford Union. It's just playing games. That does become apparent quite quickly. And I think we still have a period of 2 or 3 years in public discourse to actually try and fill it back with evidence, with fact, with a way of talking. The real worry is if we don't do it over that period, then how far does it go? And also what happens to the people who've realized that they were lied to? They either then say, let's look for something better, something more rational, or they say, let's double down, let's go further, let's, you know, really try and round up 11 million illegal immigrants. Let's have a police state. Let's actually build a wall. You know, that kind of stuff comes into being. But I think it's really all to play for. I think that's why we really have to be very careful about settling into an idea that truth is somehow over. It's not.
I'm keen to get some more questions from the audience, but like, I'm also going to ask the panelists in a bit as well about your kind of, I suppose, the cultural highlights of the year, the books, the films, and the music that stood out for you. So have a think about that. We'll get some more questions. Anyone else? Everyone's very shy, you know. We have covered the year. Actually, we've done it. Yeah, that's an hour and a quarter. We've covered the year. So, what were your books? What were your books, films, and musical highlights of the year, Elaine?
Musical highlight for me was a band called Lynched, who I had listened to a lot, but who I actually just saw live for the first time about 2 weeks ago in Vicar Street, and I just have not been blown away by a show like that in a long time. And the band themselves are just fantastic breath of fresh air, but the audience, it was the first time I've been to a gig in a long time where people didn't film it, where people did not, like, it was pin drop silent for every song and then rapturous applause at the end, as a concert should be. And I just felt a real kind of, it was the first time I've been at a gig and had that vibe in a long, long time. I really enjoyed that. Films, I thought A Date for Mad Mary was just brilliant. Best Irish film I've seen in a long, long time.
Okay.
So they'd be two for me.
Musically, there's a band called Cloudcastle Lake that I was friends with the lads when I was like 14 or 15, and they're still trucking on. I've been to quite a few of their gigs. Books, it kind of goes back to everything we're talking about. There's a book called The Art of Thinking Clearly by Rolf DeBelli, and it's kind of about everyday cognitive dissonances and the ways in which we're able to tell ourselves lies just to kind of get away with feeling okay. I think that, like, really, really resonates with what's going on kind of politically at the moment. And then culturally, I kind of didn't say I would have followed on about 1916 about poets. It's kind of Out of Resistance kind of comes revival. And definitely for me, watching Leon Bell and Waking the Feminists and seeing that kind of direct kind of protest and action and then actual kind of measurable change and sort of a benchmark for Irish theatre. So that would be in there.
Okay. Thank you. Emmett?
Books, and I can't believe the author's name just disappeared out of my head, but Beetlebone by
Kevin Barry,
yeah, of course, it was absolutely fantastic, I thought. Film, a real gem of a hungover Sunday night in Kerry, wrapped up in blankets to watch Hunt for the Wilder People by the guys who made Flight of the Conchords. It was absolutely fantastic. And music, I would have to say Another Love Story, Our Own Little Festival, but that besides, a Sunday night, again, bathed in incredible Bamminess on Inish Moor for Drop Everything, when Steffi and Virginia, two world-class DJs from the famous Berghain nightclub, played with three young guys called Alice DJs from Galway, who were seamless, which is a real moment for me that Ireland is at, you know, the pinnacle of cultural achievement. And in the midst of all this, there was an island man in his late 60s, maybe 70s, in a flat cap and a shirt, stood next to Steffi and Virginia for about an hour, just gazing at them. And I didn't know if he was being creepy or he was just interested. I couldn't really place him. And then about maybe like 12 o'clock, after being there all day from 12 o'clock in the afternoon, maybe about 12 o'clock at night, the man appeared with a tin whistle and stood next to them for about another 20 minutes. And then halfway through a breakdown of one of the songs, he busted out the best tin whistle solo you have ever heard your entire life. And to the stunned amazement of the crowd and the DJs and everyone there, we just couldn't believe it was happening. And as like he went on for as long as his lungs could possibly hold. And when he stopped, the whole place like burst into like just a huge roar, and his arms went into the air, and you saw a man's like mind literally blown. Like I don't think I'll ever forget that. So that was a great highlight, and it was a great festival as well.
Fitton, yourself, and before you kind of list them off, tell us where you stand on the whole David Simon, John Banville, fucknuts controversy.
I thought David Simon got that wrong. You know, I mean, like, everybody knows when a writer says, what writers do is this, they're talking about themselves. You know, like every writer says, the only way to do this is that. Or every artist. I mean, they see everything through their own lives. I mean, poor Banville was just trying to kind of apologize for his own kids. I mean, leave him alone, you know. Yeah. He was just trying to say, like, I wasn't a very good father, which I can quite well believe. And you know, fair, you know, leave him alone. I just think, was he making some kind of universal statement that insulted all writers? I thought it was just a bit of an overreaction. I thought in terms of some of the highlights, musically, I'm getting old now. So there was a guy called Christian Blackshaw, who's a pianist, who played the Bach piano sonatas in Kilkenny in the small church. And it was just absolutely, I mean, breathtaking. Absolutely breathtaking. He's a guy, I think he hasn't played for a long time. He's in his 60s. And he's just doing the entire cycle of these really difficult things. He didn't have a note of music in front of him. He had them all in his head. And he just played them like they were jazz or something, you know, it felt like he was kind of composing them, you know. It was just absolutely breathtaking. And you realize just, you know, and God knows we've never needed more, the transcendence, power of art. Some of the bright things for me were old people this year, you know, so maybe I'm kind of getting towards that, you know, myself. But like, just to mention three things, a book like Samuel Beckett's Letters, they finished publishing Beckett's Letters this year, the fourth volume. He's getting really old. Everything is going really badly for him. His body's falling apart. He's kind of miserable. And he's so funny. It's the greatest line I think I've read this year. Is one of his letters where he goes swimming off Tangier. He's going on holiday. Goes swimming. His dentures fall out in the sea, and he loses his dentures. You know, his teeth. You know. So and he's describing this to someone, and he says, describes what happens, and he says, speech and mastication impossible. Full stop. Drink and silence unaffected. So I'm looking on the bright side, you know. So the Beckett stuff was wonderful. Leonard Cohen, you know, doing a last album of such grace and dignity, actually getting it out before he died. I mean, maybe knowing that Trump was coming in some funny way, you know. And that voice, just that sort of thing of, you know, carrying on. And I saw one of the greatest human achievements I saw, much better than the Olympics actually, was Glenda Jackson. Not having been on stage for 25 years, she's been in Parliament for 25 years. She last acted when she was 55. She's now 80. And she said, I want to do one more thing, which is King Lear. I want to be King Lear. I want to do that on stage in the Old Vic, you know. And I mean, it's just absolutely wonderful to watch a woman with such a brilliant woman, I mean, such a sexy, smart, and she's a great feminist, by the way. She's one of the great feminist figures of our time. And she changed the way in which a woman could behave on screen more than anybody else ever did. She changed our notion of female beauty, female sexuality, you know. And for her to come back and do King Lear, she plays King Lear, which is the hardest part in existence. I mean, it's really, really incredibly difficult. It's difficult technically, huge amounts of lines, you're on stage all the time. It's really physically exhausting. And it's incredibly difficult emotionally. And I went to see her and see her do it, and you know, she does it with absolute control, absolute mastery, you know. And there's something about the human spirit, you know, about the fact of bodily decay, not being everything, you know, but there's something about people that they still have that capacity to take on and do utterly extraordinary things. And it reminds you, you know, it's been a year dominated by some of the worst creeps in humanity. And, you know, we do have to remind ourselves that there is another humanity, that there is another kind of truth, and that it's really pulsing and alive. And if we can get it back into public life somehow, we'll be okay.
I think that's the perfect way to end it. Big round of applause, please, for our four great panellists, for Elaine, Anna, Emmett and Fenton. Thank you very much. Thank you all very much for being part of it as well. Thank you all very much. I see a lot of faces in the audience. I've seen it banters over the years as well. So thank you all very much. We're back in 2017 with more. We interviewed Paul Kimmage earlier in the new year. Our first banter back in Wigwam will be one on Meet the Social Media Influencers, which will be very funny and very interesting as well, because I'm going to get them to reveal how much they actually charge for their social media influence. So just please be say thank you all very much. Have a great Christmas. And we'll see, let's be back in 2017. Like, there will be a 2017. Like, the sun will rise tomorrow. There will be a 2017. So safe home and see you all again soon. Bye-bye. Many thanks to Fenton, Elaine, Emmett and Anna for taking the time to join us at Banter. This podcast was produced by the patient, hardworking and unflappable Banter series producer Tanya White, and huge thanks to her from me for all her awesome work on this series in 2016. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news we're up to at Banter, plus you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back with more in 2017. Until then, goodbye, take care, have a great Christmas and all the best for 2017.